the meal was a little longer than sometimes, but we shouldn't wait longer than this probably for the rest of us to get here. I'm John Yoder for the benefit of the tape. And instead of the theme that had been projected at the beginning of the week for this evening, it's been decided that I should fit into the Hiroshima Day observation with the title, The Augsburg Confession and Hiroshima, with specific reference to Article 16 of that document. Let's begin with prayer. Father, we are somewhat aware, we need to be made more aware of the drama of our time, the threat that hangs over the world because of the actions of men. Teach us to find the way to subject those actions to your providence and your judgment, and to respond in our place according to your will. Amen. I'm reporting this evening on a position which is not my own, and I'll try to do that objectively. And there's a lot of content, and maybe that's all right, because the more history there is to be talked about, the less we can have a free-flowing discussion without having encountered that history. And it's part of an ongoing discussion that will continue through tomorrow, at least with the evening material. I'll still try to have some room for discussion at the end, and interrupt me if I'm utterly unclear along the way. But as a basis for the conversation we would want to have, I do need some lecture-type input. The Augsburg Confession of 1530 says in its Article 16, among other things, "It is taught among us that all government in the world and all established rule and laws were instituted and ordained by God for the sake of good order, that Christians may, without sin," usually the Lutherans talk a lot about sin, but this is one thing you can do without sin, "Christians may, without sin, occupy civil offices, serve as princes and judges, render decisions and pass sentence according to imperial and other existing laws, punish evildoers with the sword, engage in just wars, serve as soldiers, buy and sell, take required oaths, possess property, be married, etc. Condemned here are the Anabaptists." Five times the Augsburg Confession condemns the Anabaptists. That would be a subject in its own right. Who they were and whether the condemnations are fair, that is, interestingly enough, something that has popped up to the surface of the awareness in the German celebrations of the 450th anniversary of the confession, but that's not our theme for this evening. Engage in just wars is one of the things that Christians may do without sin. That's a translation of the German. In the Latin version of the confession, it's stated adverbially, "Christians may licitly wage war," but the point is obviously the same. Now, what is a just war? You probably have something of a notion about it, but let me get a running start by filling in the history of that concept. What the just war doctrine meant before, ever since the early Middle Ages, was a set of criteria whereby morally responsible Christians would refuse to say that all war is good, but would insist on discriminating. War is always evil, but sometimes it's a lesser evil. So if you're not going to give governments a blank check, which would not be morally responsible, you must distinguish between those wars which are a lesser evil and have to be tolerated without sin, and those other wars which are so evil that you shouldn't do them. That's the meaning of the doctrine of the just war, that you distinguish. You don't say all wars good, you don't say all wars wrong, you say some are bad. They're all bad, but some are lesser evils and are therefore mandatory. So you have to think, you have to look at cases. And those criteria could be divided in two general sections. What, since this is from the Middle Ages, you have to say it in Latin, jus ad bellum, that means the right to make war. It's what it takes before you start to know that there's reason for a war. There has to be a cause, and that cause must be a real offense, with the possible exception, if God tells you to go to war, then maybe there doesn't even need to be an offense. There must be stated aims, and it must be a matter of last resort. That all has to do with just cause. It can only be fought by a just authority. It can't be fought by bandits or a private citizen. That you have to know before you start. And then as you fight, there is jus in bello, the legality of carrying on the war, which means, for instance, that you respect the immunity of non-combatants, that the evil you do must be not out of proportion to the evil you're trying to prevent, that you keep the rules, whatever they be, including, for instance, in modern times, the laws of international war, or other built-in principles of fighting fair, and that your intention must not be greedy or proud or angry or hateful, but you must desire only to reestablish peace. This position was never an official doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. That is, it was never promulgated by a council or stated by a pope ex cathedra, but it was the dominant wisdom of practically all thinkers in the field in the Middle Ages. And it had been taken over by then from the pre-Christian Roman tradition. Ambrose, the father of the tradition within the Roman Catholic tradition, was a lawyer and got it from Cicero, the pagan Roman legal philosopher. The one other thing that needs to be said about the doctrine in the Middle Ages is that it was part of a much wider peacekeeping concern. The popes tried to keep Europe from blowing up militarily. They had periods. The truce of God was certain times of the year and certain times of the week when people were not supposed to fight. The peace of God was certain places where you're not supposed to fight. You shouldn't fight in cemeteries or on church property. The bishops intervened in battles to arbitrate and to see that people fought fair and that the innocent were dealt with. So the just war tradition was only a part of a much wider concern of the medieval church to keep war from getting too bad. Now, what did Martin Luther do in adopting this tradition? What was his intent? His intent was certainly to be conservative. That means to heighten the restraints. And when this doctrine is affirmed in the Lutheran Reformation, it is affirmed with a view to wanting the tradition to keep working to restrain. For instance, for Martin Luther, there could never be a justified revolution. Other Protestant groups soon came to say there could be a justified revolution. But Martin Luther said not, and you heard it in the confession. All government in the world, all established rule and laws were instituted and ordained by God. So there can't be a just revolution. In war between nations, he was concerned that there be respect for the just war tradition, although he doesn't label it in those points. He still applies it. Whoever starts a war is in the wrong. It must be a matter of last resort. And even when you are in that situation of last resort, war against equals, that means as distinguished from revolution, should be waged only when it is forced upon us, and then it should be fought in the fear of God. What does that mean? Fearing God means that we do not rely on the justness of our cause. We don't say that just because we have a just cause, anything goes, but that we are careful, diligent, and cautious, even in the very smallest details. So fighting fair. Fear of God means fighting fair. A second place where the restraint shows is that Martin Luther, at least in principle, is in favor of what in modern times we call selective conscientious objection. That is, suppose my Lord were wrong in going to war. If you know for sure that he is wrong, then you should fear God rather than man. And you should neither fight nor serve. You say, my Lord would force me to do it. He would take away my fief and would not give me money. I'd be despised and put to shame as a coward. I answer, you must take that risk. And with God's help, let whatever happens happen. He can restore it to you a hundredfold, as he promises in the gospel. So Luther calls the individual Christian soldier to cross-bearing nonconformity if he knows that it's an unjust cause. I don't know of any Lutherans doing that until the 1960s, but it's there in the writings of the Reformer. And he also condemns the mercenary trade. So Luther's intent in adopting from the tradition the just war reasoning was to maintain the concern of the medieval period for restraint. But what did Protestantism really do with this tradition when we look at the impact of Protestantism? and not just at the words of the founders. I don't know if it was yesterday evening or the night before, we were talking about healthy ecology, and Dan Kirk said that the Indians of North America had a religion which was very much at peace with nature, but some of their practice was bad ecology. Well, we do have to make a distinction between what the normative teachers teach and what a movement turns out doing. What Protestantism really did with the just war tradition was to make it much less capable of providing restraint on wars than it had been before. For one thing, the just war position now has creedal status. Roman Catholics never gave it that status. You can, in any century, be a faithful Roman Catholic and not accept the just war tradition and not be a heretic. And there have always been a few. You can't be a faithful Lutheran signing the Book of Concord, or a faithful Anglican affirming the 39 Articles, or a faithful Presbyterian affirming the Westminster Confession, or a faithful Dutch Reformed person supporting the Belgic Confession. Because there the just war tradition is taught, and the Anabaptists who deny it are condemned by name. So that war isn't wrong is given creedal status, which the medieval Catholics never said. Secondly, the Reformation coincides with and supports the creation of separate nations. Whereas in the medieval period, the notion of just war was this prince against that prince under the emperor. It was still part of the family. It was still part of the vision of a Christian Europe, which was a kind of social unity. And now we have separate nations, and by the end of this period, they'll even call themselves sovereign. That is, they'll deny that anybody else has anything to say to how they do their business, which means that the mood behind applying the restraints of the just war tradition is getting much less critical. Thirdly, the church of the Reformation is the product of the states. That is, the theologians and the pastors are put there by the government. They're much less likely to talk back to their government in terms of what the government is doing militarily than in the case of Ambrose or Augustine or the great popes, who had a considerable moral independence over against the government. Thirdly, the Reformation wiped away all the vestiges of that medieval peace vision that I talked about, the truce of God and the peace of God and the special status of clergy who aren't supposed to be violent, the religious who aren't supposed to be drafted, which actually limited the pertinence of the just war tradition to a very few people fighting. All of that special religious dimension is pushed away because Protestants don't believe in the religious dimension as a separate dimension for special people, who are the nuns and the penitents who are supposed to live different from the rest of us. More than that, the Reformation brought about wars of religion. It made religion something new to fight about. You didn't just fight about territory and dynasties. You also taught about religion, thought about religion. One more heightening of the pressure for war. And lastly, the end of the Reformation century reopened the door to the idea of righteous revolution. Luther didn't teach it, but some of the later Calvinists did toward the end of the century. That when a government is bad enough, it can be your Christian duty to rise up against it. And that is one more place from which the restraint about violence is weakened. So the impact of Protestantism on the just war tradition, despite the intention of people like Luther, was to make it less critical or less effective as a form of restraint. There are other ways the restraint has also been weakened. The changing nature of war is the simplest way to say it, that war has in many ways become total. It used to be fought by a few people, the prince and a few knights who had a noble profession fighting their privilege in society, and as many as he could pay for of mercenaries who did the dirty work and they didn't care who they worked for. But most of the population was supposed to stay home and raise the crops, and the war was not supposed to harm the crops. Now, after the age of Napoleon, every citizen is a soldier. Nobody's non-combatant. Everybody is a target because of the new weapons and delivery systems. A whole city can be attacked. Soldiers can move much faster, thanks to the railroads. So in every way, everybody's vulnerable. Everybody's guilty. Everybody's a participant in the military economy. The economic solidarity changes in the way war works, changes in the theories of national sovereignty. Everything that happened in the realities of political nationalism worked against the just war tradition having the restraining impact that it meant to have in the first place. There were some other changes on the intellectual level in the direction of more restraint, and I'll link these, a couple of them, with the names of people. Francisco Vitoria is a representative of the careful Catholic thinkers in the time of the Reformation and just after, who worked out the tradition for the first time carefully. Before that, it had only been scraps in the letters of St. Augustine or in half a chapter in the middle of Thomas Aquinas writing about something else. Only in the 16th century do we find somebody writing out a whole treatise where all of the principles of the just war get named. And so it can work as a theory, as it couldn't really before. You have the tools for thinking clearly about how you're going to criticize a war. More than that, his concern was to defend others, and not just to say our war is all right, because Vitoria was a critic of the Spanish and Portuguese invasion of South America. He was defending the rights of the original South Americans, the Indians. And he did this by saying that the just war tradition doesn't give the Spanish and Portuguese governments the right to destroy those people. Why not? Well, he had to work out the system at some care in order to defend the rights of the other side. And the notion that the just war system is a defense of the rights of the enemy got more clear in his thought. Likewise, the distinction between the just war and a crusade, that is, between a war that is a necessary lesser evil to keep something worse from happening, and a war which is commanded by God for his greater glory. Because, of course, there had been some in the Middle Ages, which weren't, according to the just war, thought properly formulated, but were called just wars too because God said you should do it, and of course that can't be wrong. Now we're beginning to see that the concept of crusade, a holy war where God commands you to go destroy those people, and a justifiable war where in the political realism of the situation you can't do otherwise than to use war to defend some value, that distinction is clear after Vitoria. Another man can be used as a symbol, that's Hugo Grotius, a Dutchman who was working as a diplomat for various governments around Europe. He transposed this ethical idea, that is the idea that certain acts are right and wrong, into legal language so that you could use it in the courts or so the diplomats could use it to arbitrate conflicts or so that the status of people could be determined as to whether they came from a belligerent nation or not in order to know whether seizing a ship is an act of war or piracy or something else. The beginning of international relations as a profession, as an intellectual discipline, and as a set of institutions in the 17th and 18th centuries meant that the idea that some things might be declared wrong on the grounds of law was an application of the just war theory, making it more serious, at least on the intellectual level, although those international court relationships were never very powerful. And then we're almost up to the present, but there is a renewal of the Catholic concern for how bad things are. That is not saying that war must not happen, but just saying, isn't it too bad that it is as bad as it is? After the Napoleonic Wars and the Crimean War and the American Civil War, the Roman Catholic bishops of the world were starting to say, the way war is getting total, it can't fit the just war tradition. They were ready to say that at the Vatican Council in 1870. And then that council didn't meet or didn't finish its meeting because it spent all the time it had on deciding the Pope was infallible. And then the Franco-Prussian War broke out and the Vatican was invaded and they couldn't finish their meeting. So this didn't get on the agenda after all. But they were ready, and that's important, that Catholic thought was more careful than Protestant thought in saying this war phenomena is going too far. It's disproportionate to anything you might have the right to use it for. In 1930s, it was, again, Catholic thinkers, a minority of people on the fringe, but they were there, who started saying that the massive bombardment of cities is not morally permissible according to the Christian tradition because it can't possibly respect the immunity of non-combatants. And this was before Hiroshima. It was on the basis of the last months of the First World War and what people had seen about the destructive potential that air war was going to have the next time around. They knew that already in the 20s and were writing about it in the 30s. And this is then the position that will come over a certain brink of visibility after Hiroshima. And the last kind of changes in the direction of restraint is the development of a rather impressive network of treaties. We don't hear about them much because we're not diplomats, but beginning in the 1850s, and especially in the last quarter of the last century, culminating around the turn of the century in the treaties of Geneva and The Hague, a lot of formal commitments to fighting fair were signed by all the major nations. And most of those have been kept. And they have status of law in most of the nations. They aren't everything, but they're there, they're on record, and the nations have an interest in keeping them, because if we respect them, then they'll have to too. They had limits. They didn't apply to new weapons, of course, but they were a sign of trying to make the just war mentality operational by saying that we commit ourselves to fight according to the rules. And the last element of that kind that comes after Hiroshima, but is still not about the nuclear issue, is the renewal of selective conscientious objection. And this is, as far as I see, only happened with any clarity in the American Vietnam experience. For the first time that was a widespread thing, where a considerable number of young men subject to the draft said, they're not sure all war is wrong, they're not members of a historic peace church, they're not sure that the war against Hitler was wrong, they're not sure that the war in Korea where their uncle fought was wrong, but they know this war is not right. And it's their Christian duty, not all of them were Christian, but some of them were, it's their moral duty to refuse to fight in an unjust war. Selective conscientious objection, which the American law does not recognize as conscientious objection, but is a proof that the just war way of thinking can be operational. Now to look to Hiroshima specifically. What if we apply the just war criteria to that event? We can't ask about the cause for which the war is fought, because, of course, that had been was a much larger question and had been going on for several years. That would call for a different debate. But assuming that the war of the Allies against Japan was in itself justified at the start, was this act of war justified? We can ask the question of authority. Obviously, the American government had the right to wage war for the Americans. But in the details of the decision to go over the nuclear threshold, that is less clear. That is, nobody had run for office on the basis of the program that he would escalate into nuclear war. In fact, the president at the time hadn't run for office with any program. He just got in on Roosevelt's coattails, and then Roosevelt died. So the passing of the threshold was not mandated by any electoral or legislative process. Even the decision-making process, to the extent to which we can reconstruct it, was not clearly carried out in a way where everybody was talking the same language and everybody knew what was at stake. And that between the scientists who developed the instrument and some of the military people and some other military people, President Truman just really getting into his presidency, it isn't clear that that decision was clean and according to due process. In fact, it seems, according to some, that President Truman, right at the outset, was either misinformed or lied to the public, because he himself announced that it had been used on a military target when it was used on the center of a dense city. We can't say that the war wasn't being fought by somebody who had the right to fight for America, but we can have some doubts about the escalation being justified. But of course, the main criterion is the obliteration of the civilian population of a city. Now, that's not a brand new idea. That idea was dealt with in the treaties I talked about. In the Second World War, there was a widespread public debate in Great Britain, not much in America. But in the public in Great Britain, it was debated with people like George Orwell, the famous writer of 1984, saying, as long as we're going to fight, we might as well not recognize any limits. The more we kill, the better, because we just want to get it over. And other people, not only pacifists, saying we must still fight according to the rules of international law, and we must respect the innocent. There was a debate within the Church of England with Archbishop Temple in favor of less restraint and Archbishop Bell of Chichester in favor of more restraint. There was even a debate between the American Air Force and the British Air Force. The American Air Force didn't want to bomb cities because they had planes that could fly higher and bomb sites that were accurate enough that they could fly above the German anti-aircraft and hit a military target. The British couldn't fly above the anti-aircraft, and therefore they had to fly at night, and therefore they couldn't see their targets, and they didn't have good bomb sites anyway, so they just had to bomb the whole city. And that corresponded also to a difference of mentality between the British General Harris and the American General Arnold. So there were actual debates between the nations. So it was not a new question when Hiroshima happened that you ought to think about the immunity of civilians. It didn't come up just from these Catholic theologians that I mentioned who were writing about it in the 30s, who probably weren't read by anybody at that time. But it was represented in the internal discussion. And it's clear that there are no criteria of the just war tradition according to which it can ever have been permissible to bomb the center of a city, even less without any warning, and even less without any claim that it's because of a special military importance of that city, or technical importance to the maintenance of the war effort. Further, it wasn't a matter of last resort. The criterion of last resort applies before you get into a war, but in the war also it applies to any escalation or any new strategy. The Japanese were suing for peace at the time. It's not proportionate, although there's an argument that is worth mentioning. It was mentioned this morning. It was argued later by American military people, not by Truman, but by other people, that we saved lives by doing it this way, because if there had to be a battle on the ground to invade Japan and take over Japan completely through military conquest, many more lives would have been taken. That might have been if the Japanese hadn't been willing to surrender, or if the fact of a successful invasion hadn't led them to surrender right away. It's thinkable, although it's a worst-case hypothesis. But in that case, the deaths would have been military deaths. And these are civilian deaths, and you can't count those against each other in the proportionality rules of the just war tradition. And lastly, the goal, the stated goal of the choice of this weapon was to bring Japan to an unconditional surrender. If the Japanese had been told that the Americans or the Allies would be satisfied with a surrender in which Hirohito would keep his office, the Japanese might have sued for peace even earlier. Unconditional surrender is not a morally permissible war aim, according to the just war tradition. You fight for peace. You fight for a just peace. There must always be stated war aims according to which the adversary can have peace by giving in. So the very phrase, unconditional surrender, which was settled on by Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin in a meeting in Casablanca in the middle of the war, for morale reasons, was immoral. And its application to Hiroshima was also immoral. Not according to my views. I'm reporting on somebody else's tradition. Your tradition, if you're Lutheran, or Anglican, or Presbyterian, or most Catholics. And according to that tradition, unconditional surrender is never a valid war aim. So any action made on the basis of that goal is also not valid. Now, lastly, to move into the present, what about the arms race as we see it now, a third of a century later, as represented by the new mood of the Reagan administration on warming up the arms race, and as seen by Washington's distinctive identity on the with the Trident bases? Can we measure this phenomenon by the just war tradition? It's made hard by the fact that the people who aren't pacifists and therefore would claim to be living according to the just war tradition aren't working very clear on making it work. It is, if you cared about it much, you would teach it to your teenagers. How many of you come from churches where the just war criteria are taught to your teenagers? As John Schramm sometimes says, you're just looking at me. No, the people who say they believe in it don't make that belief instrumental by thinking together about what the line would be beyond which it would not be proper to go. And our government doesn't make it any easier by not sharing with us in detail the criteria that the government itself thinks would govern the use of these weapons, especially the most escalated weapons. Theologians taking seriously the just war tradition, I think this is a fair statement, do not admit, any of them that I've seen writing seriously on the subject, that there can be any justified use of the amount of destruction that would happen from the serious use that is more than just a test or a single shot of these weapons from the perspective of proportion. That is, whatever be the stakes, it isn't a possible defense against that evil to blow up the world. The criterion of proportionality. If things get worse, then according to the theory, you may do worse. And if they get still worse, you may do still worse. But if you blow up the world, that can't be a lesser evil. Just be honest with the argument. So there must be a stopping point somewhere in the logic of it, and every honest theologian admits that, although there are different degrees of clarity with which they then move on from there. A second strike readiness, that is, a readiness to fire back after an attack, after a major attack, denies the criteria of due process and last resort of the classical doctrine, because the classical doctrine said after you get attacked, you have to make sure that the enemy meant to attack you, that it wasn't a mistake, it wasn't a misunderstanding, that he isn't ready to back out. All of this is excluded by the second strike readiness, which they tell us the most about. At the same time, there is a growing readiness in American policy circles to talk in the open about a first strike. And that is never justifiable according to anybody's just war theory within the tradition of the people writing on morals. Brian Hare is the person in the Washington office, the Council of Bishops, who has the most to say for the Roman Catholic Church in this area. He wrote in March a summary article saying just about what I have said, that nobody who does moral theology can justify a first strike or an all-out second strike. That's what the theologians say, he said. But the military strategists keep on planning for a war in which they're going to use these weapons. Some of you may have seen in early June a series of documentaries on CBS about American atomic readiness. They made it quite clear that the current language of the American military strategist is the integrated battlefield, which means you have all the weapons possible available. Nuclear, bacterial, chemical, you only use what you have to. But there are no fire breaks and there are no barriers before the use of more and worse if you think you need it in a particular situation. One of the other ways of putting the classical criteria is to use the term discrimination. That is, can you aim your weapon? You have to aim your weapon, A, in order not to hit innocent civilians, and B, you have to aim it in order not to do disproportionate damage, even to real enemies. Modern technology eliminates discrimination by not making it possible to target that precisely, or by having the explosive capacity so large that the wider destruction or fallout recognize no limits. The only case remaining within the just war tradition that some people do argue is deterrence by bluff. That is, we threaten them with the use, they threaten us with the use, and the threat may somehow keep the other party from going ahead with what they could do, but if it ever fails to stop them, well, then it's too late. And there's no point in using it. If they strike first, there is no moral case for striking back. There's nothing to save anymore. But we have to make them think we want to strike back. Otherwise, the deterrence won't work. So I've heard people seriously say that they know that Jimmy Carter, I don't know if they'd say it about Ronald Reagan, in those last 10 minutes, after a first strike by the Russians, would know that there's nothing to be gained by striking back. And he wouldn't do it. But he can't tell anybody that, because then the whole system would break down. He can't even tell the Pentagon that. He can't even tell the higher officers that. Everybody has to believe we're ready to strike, and then maybe we have the moral freedom not to. And that's called democratic politics. That the most optimistic thing we can say is that we trust the man at the top of the country will have the moral integrity to do the opposite of what he's been telling us for 4 years he was getting ready to do, because it would be a sin to do it. Even if there were a case for deterrence by some threat, that would be no grounds for 95% of the weapons we have, because it would take only one Trident. In fact, it would only take one of the present Polaris submarines with the newer missiles to destroy 200 Soviet cities with the MIRV missiles. Anything beyond one Polaris, or if they're going to have bad aim, anything beyond two Polarises hitting half their targets is overkill. So the arms race has no justification at all beyond that fragment of the amount that we have. And this is to say nothing about the economic impact of the race, that's the money we waste on it, or the ecological impact, using up our resources and radiation and all the rest. So that if the just war position is taken with moral seriousness by people who are not pacifists, it calls for effective restraint. And that effective restraint will be very different from pacifism in the way it argues. But if it is to have moral integrity and political integrity in our society, it won't be very different from pacifism in what it would lead people to do. So I did get done time for some conversation. It might even be that the word just war that you have in the German Augsburg Confession ought to be talked about a little more. There it says, in fact, it says it's without sin, which is a funny thing for Lutherans to say, because most of the time they say everything's sinful. And you should sin bravely. But it seems to say that it's a good thing to do. The tradition never meant that, and I've tried to say that on the way through. We should say the justifiable war theory. Because it isn't that it's good or that you ever enjoy it, but it's a lesser evil, and in that sense it's justified. So it's the justifiable war theory, if we wanted to be most precise semantically. But mostly we don't want to be precise semantically. And when the ordinary usage of that circulates in the texts, people think that means, well, war is okay, isn't it? Because after all, we're not pacifists. And we are responsible. So generally, the readiness of Protestants since the 17th century to accept war when government calls for it has been giving the just war language a meaning it didn't mean to have in the first place. It meant to be a regrettable concession to an awful situation. But since the rise of nationalism and Christian patriotism, especially after the Reformation when you had national churches, it came to mean war is all right. Our sovereign is put there by God, and if our sovereign says we go to war, that's all we need to ask. And that has been, I suspect, the real dominant Protestant position through the centuries. And that's not the just war position. That is an anything-goes position, which is nearer to Machiavelli or to the Crusade than it is to the justifiable war. And Luther was against Machiavelli and the Crusade, against the idea that the sovereign is his own boss, and against the idea that war can have a transcendent moral purpose, religious moral purpose.
John, you talked about war has changed now and how everyone is fair game and we're all involved. Military budget, we're all paying for it. Do you think that you could find in the Lutheran tradition sources who would support a position of war tax resistance, or would you have to go outside the Lutheran tradition for that?
Well, I could only see that argument working by extension. That is, Luther says, if your prince wages a just war, you refuse to fight. And you could say that in the modern situation where we see more clearly, or it wasn't even the case in the Middle Ages in the same sense, that everything we do supports the war effort, that our duty to do what Luther said about an unjust war will have to hack in an earlier point. But it would be a derived argument. We couldn't say it's there in the tradition. But selective refusal to participate in a battle is. and I haven't found it elsewhere. Since the Reformation texts aren't on computers, you can never say you've done a search. But I don't know of another person in 1525 or 26 who was saying he ought to be a selective conscientious objector. So that is your wedge in the tradition for asking more questions about how it is your duty today to be against an unjust war, if you are not simply the hireling soldier, but also the citizen and the agent of financing the effort.
When the Augsburg Confession was written, they were dealing with, quote unquote, I guess, not maybe the time of the Holy Roman Empire, which wasn't holy, wasn't Roman, wasn't an empire, but they were thinking in that line, and they were even dealing with Russia being the Eastern Orthodox Church, but the mental set today of we with our beliefs dealing with another belief, like with China or with the Russians today, whatever goes, whatever works, how do we approach that? Do we approach it still from the Augsburg Confession? I have a problem with it. I'm with it, but we're looking at a different side that, I guess I see a side that whatever seems to work for them, they use it. They say they'll do one thing, but if it works for them, they take off and do another.
Well, one way to formulate that question would be, if the enemy doesn't play fair, does that let us off the hook?
I don't believe so.
Whether the enemy be modern Russia or somebody else. And of course, morally, it wouldn't, and Luther would say it wouldn't. Another question, another way of putting the question, would be whether the phenomenon that is represented for us by the Soviet threat is so different that it opens a new chapter. And there, I think not, because Luther had the Turk. And the Turk represented for Luther something very much like what the communist means to us. Came from the East, was knocking at the doors of Vienna every century or so, and was really feared. And Luther saw the Turk partly as the hand of God to chastise an unfaithful Christendom, but also partly as those people outside the law that have no principles or only wrong ones because they talk about God but don't talk about God right. I just happened while I was looking at this text on a place where he said the Turk and the Pope are just the same because they both use the scriptures and talk about Jesus, but wrong. So there was something very much like our sense of that big block over there in the East. And yet Luther wouldn't say we should fight the Turk a holy war. If a particular Turkish invasion threatens the peace of Saxony, well, then you should defend Saxony. But not the Muslim threat as itself reason for a crusade. In fact, there were pretty soon going to be Protestants under the Turks who found that it was better to live there than under the Roman Catholics or under the Eastern Orthodox in Transylvania. There was a blooming Lutheran culture within a couple of generations. And the Turks treated them better than the Catholics would have, or than the Lutherans would have treated the Turks. Wes?
John, you've done such a brilliant job in defending the theory, you know, that you don't hold. I wonder whether there are some difficulties in it, difficulties with the just war theory in the face of the nuclear age. That one of the primary ones I've thought about, I'm interested in your reflections. We have many more tactical nuclear weapons than strategic nuclear weapons, and it seems that the way in which nuclear weapons would, I fear, most first be used would be, in fact, the use of a small tactical nuclear weapon in a surgical strike against a specific military target with a very, quote, clean weapon, very little fallout, used and justified in purely military terms. Nevertheless, an act which would cross the nuclear threshold. The kinds of things that come up in a lot of war game scenarios. And it seems that the just war theory has far less ability to discriminate at that point. In fact, sometimes you even get people arguing, well, it would allow that sort of thing. I wonder whether your reflections or thoughts on that.
It helped to bring us into a new sense of how bad things were, that the initial use was counter-city. And there has remained the sense of a firebreak that the qualitative move into nuclear is qualitatively big, even if quantitatively isn't very much. That is, if you had a tiny bomb and used it only on an aircraft carrier in the middle of the ocean, the fact that you get over the nuclear firebreak is a psychological and dramatic political offense. That's one of the things that, the theory can't handle very well, the notion of a qualitative change. It can be argued that even Hiroshima was not as bad as the things we did to Tokyo. We firebombed Tokyo and killed more people, more horribly. And if I'm going to be killed in a bombing, I'd rather be atomized as in Hiroshima than roasted for 4 hours as they did in Tokyo. And so with conventional weapons, you can do worse things. And in that sense, the measurements of proportion that the just war tradition tells us we can do are very hard to do with any logical tenability. So that to the extent to which they can make the case for nice, small, clean, aimable nuclear weapons, that would push some just war thinkers to say, well, yes, then, maybe that far. But the line beyond that will be harder to respect than the line before that. And if you're talking about the political realism of applying a line, then a line that's easier to apply, even if it has to be applied sooner, is more realistic than a line that's harder to apply, even though you can make the case for pushing it back a little. So the doctrine was not made to do that political psychology stuff. It assumed that you could measure proportion and you can know what's a lesser evil and you know what's going to happen from a weapon. It was a medieval doctrine. In the time when you were talking about finite qualities and how many lives one soldier could only kill one soldier at a time. It's in that world that it makes sense. So it could well be that the messiness of application would mean that we could never have a clean interpretation of what it would mean even if we believed in the doctrine fully. But at least it excludes trident. It excludes anything you can do with a trident, or anything you can do with a Polaris, or anything you can do with an MX.
It seems to me that it's important as Lutherans to remember that the Augsburg Confession is never put on the same, you call it the creedal. It's not on the same par as the Catholic creeds, the creeds of faith. But more important, it's not put on the same par, the same importance to our lives as Scripture is. And I, as one who's not ordained yet and hasn't signed that thing saying I accept the confessions, and then I can say that I think there are places in which the confessions no longer interpret Scripture completely or fully. And I think we make a mistake as Lutherans to use Augsburg Confession as the place we must stand, when I think it's more important to use Scripture as the place that's finally, as our confessions say, the rule and norm for our lives.
Well, I mean, the Augsburg Confession would say that, but the political reality, or the social and political reality of Protestant national churches with the Westminster Confession and 39 Articles and Augsburg has implemented the view that you don't support. So when I report on cultural history, I have to report it this way. If I report on proper theological ethics, I'd say it your way.
I guess what I'm trying to say is I think it's important for Lutherans not only to look at the just war theory, which is part of our confessional history, but to look beyond that to scriptural statements about violence and aggression and peacemaking, because finally that's where we stand. So there's room to be a Lutheran pacifist, I think.
But then you'd have to sign this with either mental reservations or stated reservations, or stop signing. I'm not sure all Lutheran churches require a signature of assent to the Book of Concord anymore, but they did recently.
When you're ordained, you have to say something.
John, I'm not sure that it's always solving things to clarify language. I think sometimes we don't really change either attitudes or actions by changing language. On the other hand, I think language is very important, and I'd like to underline the difference between just war and justifiable war. I think it would be a great step forward if we used justifiable war or 4 years I traveled among Lutheran churches, and I didn't have an assumption that I would be converting people to pacifism. I did have the assumption that it would be important for us to know our own tradition. So there are at least study guides that list the justifiable war criteria. I found very few Lutherans who knew them. The young people who struggled through the Vietnam era, and therefore any adults in their parish who were in on that, knew them, but that's really very recent. I also personally think that you can speak to Lutherans, and you've added the other groups, Presbyterians, Anglicans, what have you, that those criteria add up not only to selective conscientious objection. I continue to use a different phrase, and I think people got a different impression. I think our stand leads to selective conscientious participation. In other words, the burden of the proof, if you came to the Christian community, you'd never have to assume, you have to convince them that you object to war. The assumption is non-participation. If you came to the Christian community with your reason why, in conscience sake, you thought this time participation in the violence was called for and asked for their support, that gives a very different feel to stance and role of Christian community. And we are far from that. I really think our criteria add up to that. I don't think that's just pushing, and I think it's more than semantics, but it would help if we clarified our language. And just war is a very poor way to describe our historic position. I agree with you.
It can be argued, and Luther would have said that, since the citizen doesn't know as much as the prince does, he should give the prince the burden of the proof. So he should do peacetime military training. But you still need selective grounds for going to war. So I think both of the semantic changes you argued for are proper. That is, it is participation in any violent action that has the burden of proof, according to this theory, in its proper understanding.
Correct. And someone like Dick McSorley, out of the Jesuit tradition, some of his writings show that there has never been a justifiable war by the justifiable war criteria, especially last resort or other things. And for those of you who wondered, if there are those who wondered why there were so many selective conscientious objectors among the Lutheran Church, the Vietnam conflict was eliminated by all of the criteria, including declared by Congress. So both the ones that you needed before you started it and in the waging of it, and the law of proportionality was never more flagrantly denied than we bombed the city to save it, or we destroyed the city to save it.
The nuclear threshold of Hiroshima and the consciousness threshold of Vietnam, in a sense, have done a service to the wider Christian community by making the questions unavoidable. They haven't changed the doctrines, but they have pushed across all the thresholds. So now it's put up or shut up. If you believe in this doctrine, you'll have to say no to something. So if you don't say no to something, it's all a moral farce. That wasn't that clear before you were before Vietnam.
Thank you.